We've heard the politicians and the eco-activists' views on the Shumava, but what do the scientists say? And by the way, how do cells read DNA anyway? That's what we'll be trying to get our heads around this month on Science Journal. Where do the trillions of cells in the human body, or other bodies for that matter, get their instructions from? They read the book of DNA. But how? No one has yet been able to quite figure that out. Scientists from the Molecular Genetics Institute of the Czech Academy of Sciences have taken a good step in the right direction, though, helping to explain how histones, special proteins that help protect DNA in the cell nucleus, can change certain molecules of RNA if they are modified only slightly. Meanwhile, it's incorrect changes to RNA splices that cause a number of diseases, so learning to properly modify the histones could be a step towards curing certain tumorous or neurodegenerative diseases. But why try to explain it poorly myself when I can get expert explanations from Dr. David Staniak of the Molecular Genetics Institute, whose team made the discovery?
All information is stored in DNA about the cells and their shape and communication stored in DNA. What we try to study is how cells read that information, because that information is rather hidden in DNA, and it's actually tricky for cell to read it and get a meaningful information, let's say, out of it. So that's what we study, the process, how cells read the information stored in DNA. We just push it a bit farther. So the trick is that, how to explain that? So information in DNA is basically stored to make proteins, okay? The proteins are actually the working units of cells. They are enzymes, you know, they can make a beer, I mean, they can color your hair. They do many things, proteins.
Okay, I'm with you so far, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so, and how they make proteins? The proteins have a specific sequence. Each protein has a specific sequence. And that sequence is stored in DNA, okay? The problem is, and we don't know actually why, and especially in human DNA, to make one protein, the information is stored in different places. It's like, I don't know, like a pearls in a necklace. You can put them together, okay? Like little pearls, put them together. Or, I don't know, you're in the radio. So if you cut a tape, okay, you put the, you know, scenes you want to together and glue it together. And that's exactly how the cells do it. They take, you know, they translate the information from DNA and just glue together a little pieces. Is that clear?
Yes, that's clear. And so they put together the relevant information from various sources, just like
a
radio reporter.
Exactly. And then different cells can actually put the different, you know, these little pieces together. So from one, you know, DNA sequence, they can make actually different proteins. I mean, it's like a movie. You can glue, like, let's say, happy end or a tragedy and just, you know, changing the end. You totally change the meaning of the movie. And that's how cells work, actually. You know, they can take, just change a piece of a protein and actually change totally the function of that protein.
And so your insight into this process...
Yeah, so what was not clear how cells are actually putting these little pieces together, why one cells put a piece A, B, C, while the other cells put together A, B, and D. So, and what we did actually, we found a piece of information that cells are using to put the correct pieces together, okay?
And these are the histones.
Well, that comes to histones. So DNA, you know, just all this putting pieces together is done at the RNA. So there's DNA, information is stored. From DNA, it's transcribed into RNA. Then there's all shuffling and putting pieces together and cutting the others out is done at the RNA level. And then RNA serves as a template for a protein, okay? And till now, everybody believed that all information, you know, of all the process of, you know, RNA shuffling, which is actually called RNA splicing or alternative splicing, is done at the RNA level. And what we found is actually that the DNA template and DNA is wrapped around histones. And the histones have a little, like, hacks on it that usually tell cells, okay, this is gene, this is not the gene, transcribe that, not transcribe that. What we found that also histones and this histone code with little text can tell cells how to splice RNA. So we actually basically put together two processes that were not connected till now.
And so this discovery also means that it's possible to influence the histones with various substances.
Well, it's been known for a long time, in 5 years, that histones and these little tags can be influenced. There are enzymes that can put these tags on or, you know, take them off. And we have a little chemical so that can actually inhibit or enhance those enzymes. So that way we can actually change this histone code. Until now, it was used to change the histone code to change gene expression, meaning, you know, not transcribing or transcribing some genes. And so now we found that also those little chemicals that change the histone code can be used also for changing RNA splicing. And we know that there are several diseases there where the splicing is wrong, and that's what causes disease. So there's a potential, and we haven't tested yet that it's just a potential. I mean, it could be, it may not work, but it could be used to actually correct the missplicing that causes some human, you know, hereditary diseases.
And what kind of diseases does that entail exactly?
Well, the splicing diseases are several of them. There's spinal muscular atrophy, which actually causes death of, you know, child, that, you know, neurons do not develop. So that's a problem. And there's a lot of muscular dystrophies. Other muscular dystrophies are, you know, caused by missplicing. And we know that also now retinitis pigmentosa, which is a hereditary disease, can be partially caused by wrong splicing. So there are several diseases where splicing is wrong. And we may test now, or you know, other labs may test whether those different chemicals that change histone code can also somehow influence RNA splicing and correct RNA splicing.
Is that the first testing that you'll do? Will you jump into trying to correct RNA splicing?
Well, we work on RNA splicing. That's our job. But, I mean, there are many labs that are way ahead of us on how these different diseases work. And they understand in detail how those, you know, splicing can be corrected. So I don't think that's our job. We put that information out and they can use it.
And so how will you go about testing it?
How we will go about this? Well, we would rather go more in a basic biology, and we would like to understand how cells and how different cells in our body using this histone code, and how, you know, let's say, you know, we have neurons, we have muscles, and they all have the same DNA, but they are totally different, they look different, and part of that is done by RNA splicing. So we would like to understand whether the histone code, whether histone code in these different cells can influence different alternative splicing, and understand that way how cells in our body read the information more, you know, go more toward the really basic science, understanding how our body and our cells are working.
What's fuzzy and brown, only 5 millimeters long, and can devour a forest? None other than Ips typographus, better known as the bark beetle, which has done untold damage to one of the most important natural preserves in the Czech Republic, the Šumava, or Bohemian Forest. Part of the UNESCO Biosphere Reserve, and one of the most beautiful places in the country for hiking or skiing, when a tree falls in the Bohemian Forest, whether at the hands of loggers or the mandibles of the bark beetle, everyone hears it. The ongoing debate that we have followed for years now is whether to combat the infestation by logging the infested areas, as the current park management wants to do, or to leave Mother Nature to her own devices to clean up after herself. We hear from the politicians and environmental groups on a regular basis, but less so from the natural scientists. For that sake, I've called Dr. Jan Froes of Charles University's Institute for Environmental Studies, who I asked for a judgment on the polarized positions.
Well, certainly on the both sides, we can see quite strong simplification of the question asked and of the positions. I would rather be in favor of activists because they at least, you know, affect general attention to the problem. The major problem here is that there is a sort of conflict between keeping the nature and providing, let's say, better infrastructure for park and making park more attractive for more demanding tourist industry.
And so ecologically, how can that best be achieved?
This is a very delicate question, because basically there is many studies from Alpine region and other mountain region around the world showing that basically you have a summer and winter visitors. The winter visitors really need a large infrastructure because they don't really see much nature. So what they need is a snow hill and, you know, convenient transportation, very comfort up and down, you know, high quality food. They have to have something after they go skiing. So they have to have, you know, some kind of entertainment or some kind of other services. They are very valuable in terms of money for enterprisers. So they try to accommodate them. But the problem is, more you accommodate the winter visitors, more you damage your nature. And you suffer to get summer visitors, because the summer visitors are coming particularly to see nature. So there are two things are going to happen. You are losing the essence why the national park was created, but you are also losing the nature, which is economic attraction for summer tourism. And all the studies made in foreign countries show that regardless, you know, how good conditions you have for skiing, you cannot survive exclusively on winter visitors. So it's a very delicate balance. And simply what we are seeing here now is an attempt from, you know, park management to take a shortcut in this and accommodate, you know, local enterprisers in the short-term run, which politically may be highly appreciated, but in long term, it's not a good step.
Well, how would you describe the consensus? In what kind of consensus is there in the scientific community as to how the situation and infestation should be dealt with?
I mean, there is, I should say, the scientific community is also quite diverse in this, I should say openly. But speaking about environmentalists and people with ecological background, there is quite a consensus that we, in order to keep a national park, we should first try to keep natural processes. The first things to remember is that the nature are not only the species we are going to keep there. I mean, you can go to botanical garden or you can go to zoological garden to see the species, but that would not be the same as having the same species in national park in their natural environment. So the national environment consists from all the national processes that are going to happen. And disasters like wind or bark beetle are inherent part of these natural processes. There is many parts in Shimoga Mountains where probably such events happen quite periodically, means, you know, in order each 100, 150 years. So it's maybe not in the same extent, but what we are seeing, it's quite a natural process. And
so then the activists are essentially correct in your view that they should not allow logging at all and leave the forest to its own?
Well, you have to distinguish between area when the natural spruce forest, when the spruce forest is natural, and in the other area when the spruce forest was planted, when the originally was a beech forest. Certainly in area when the spruce forest was planted, when we have artificial plantation now, there is a quite logical to proceed by classical forest management and use logging. But in the places when there was natural spruce forest, there is quite a consensus among ecological community, environmental community, that these sites have to be put to its natural development. This is historical thing, because in Czech there is a long tradition of growing spruce artificially. So general public have really, you know, very bad feeling about leaving a spruce by its own. And it's a cultural thing. But if you go to, let's say, Siberia, there is a quite large area of spruce forest. And there is a quite large area of harvesting of spruce forest and nobody planting that spruce back. The simple law says that if you harvest the forest, you have to leave all trees which have diameter 7 centimeter or less. And if you came to that harvested forest, let's say 2 years after, you see most of the trees in the forest would be up to 1 meter high, or, you know, some would be even taller, like 5, 7, 10 meters. Of course, majority of trees would be very small seedlings. You get quite high speed of recovery, with fast recovery, and you get huge diversity of ages and sizes of trees. This is something the foresters would not like particularly, because it makes forest management much more difficult. But it's something which an environmentally oriented scientist would welcome, because you get forest which is more heterogeneous in terms of age, and that forest would get much more resistant, for example, to bark beetles or to some wind or other, you know, natural disasters, and would also support much larger diversity of species because of more diversity of habitats.
Dr. Jan Froes of the Institute for Environmental Studies there, ending this month's edition of Science Journal. We'll be with you again for more science news in roughly 27 days, 23 hours, and 45 minutes. Until then, goodbye.